Just because they're out on the street and homeless and don't have a job doesn't mean they're not human. They should have human rights where they have a place to live and have something to eat every day, you know?
The biggest thing is when you start losing yourself, you feel like you have no worth. You have nothing to give back. You get deeper into your addictions, and the more guilt you got because you're not around your family, or and it's getting worse.
Affordable housing is so important. It's the basis to everything. Having stability. And if you have stability, you're able to cope a lot better with, you know, COVID, mental health, addiction. Without affordable housing, without that stability, the rest of that's going to affect your life so much more.
I've never been this well. I swear to goodness, in my entire life.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Winter is Coming. This is a podcast where we are asking how we go from housing crisis to housing justice. And what you just heard at the start of today's episode was the audio from Safe, which is a documentary film from John Butler, a documentary that features tenants of the Indwell affordable housing communities and their stories of being targeted by housing injustice, of living close to the streets, and the hope that comes with supportive, permanent, affordable housing. And if you want to learn more about how you can support the documentary, how you can view that documentary, check out the details in the captions to this podcast, or Google Safe Documentary or search YouTube for Safe Documentary. On this show, we host conversations with folks who are doing work in the scene, confronting the housing crisis that we find ourselves in here, not just in this land that we now call Canada, but all over, sometimes specifically in the areas that are traditionally the territories of the Haudenosaunee, the Anishinaabe, and Neutral peoples that we now call Kitchener-Waterloo, but also looking at how this crisis and how the issue of housing injustice continues to pervade our society as we ask, how do we move from housing crisis to housing justice? And when we talk about housing justice here on the show, we're talking about the comprehensive approach that doesn't only mean putting roofs over people's heads, doesn't only mean bringing prices down to a level that is more affordable, but really tackling the issues that face people of all walks of life and many income levels that move us towards a place where we truly have housing practically, materially enshrined as a human right. So that's what we mean when we talk about housing justice here on the show, Winter is Coming. We call it Winter is Coming because no matter when you're listening, winter is either here or the next winter is coming. And that is a reality that is always with us, particularly for our neighbors who struggle with housing, who are confronted with housing injustice. And so it's something that we want to imprint on ourselves and remember too. We are starting out season two here of this show. You can go back and listen to episodes from season one on the links that are attached to this podcast. You just search Winter is Coming on any major podcast platform. And we are starting out season two with some familiar voices and some new voices. Today, we have on a new voice and a new organization to us, not new in its existence, but new to the show that we want to chat with and introduce and hear stories from. And that is Beyond Housing. And so we have Dan Dreger here, who is the executive director of Beyond Housing. And Dan, we're really grateful that you made time, especially in your busy schedule, leading your organization to sit down and have a conversation with me today.
Yeah, well, absolutely thrilled to be part of this. I've listened to some of the broadcasts and I just hope I can live up to the standard of the people that have come before, because there's some very smart, very thoughtful people that have been on this show. And I've learned a lot listening to it as well.
Awesome. Absolutely. Well, I have no worry of that. And we are just excited, especially because we haven't had a chance to share about the work that Beyond Housing is today, too. So I know it's going to be a really valuable conversation for folks listening, because we have folks listening who are working in the housing scene, everywhere from in the trenches, in emergency shelters, to doing engineering, thinking about how we change our whole societal approach to housing. We have people who are listening who are part of community groups, who are neighbors, who are activists, who are regular people, who are United Church folks or beyond the United Church, people who just see that we have more than a problem, that we have a crisis, and that we need to work together to respond to it. And so being able to learn a little bit about Beyond Housing and about your work with Beyond Housing, I know is going to be really valuable for us understanding more, because as we've heard many times, housing, to confront the housing crisis, it is not a one size fits all approach. We need a comprehensive strategy. We need to be able to see different approaches, different philosophies. And so to hear now from Beyond Housing and the particular context that you work in and the approach that you take, something I'm really excited to chat about. So my first question for you is kind of, we often start off with a personal one, which is for you, Dan, kind of even before perhaps Beyond Housing was a hat that you wore, maybe. How did you first get introduced to either the housing crisis or the term or idea of affordable housing or supportive housing, or this idea of housing justice, which again just means, you know, the approach of we want to see housing enshrined as a human right? How did that first come to your attention?
Yeah, I think the issue around housing probably came to me as a child or as a youth, and I'm going to go into the way back machine here and go back quite a number of years. I grew up in a farm up in the Bruce County area, and we actually had a number of farms. And at the time, when you owned some land and bought a farm, by default, it came often with a house, often with an old farmhouse. And so by default, we became landlords. You know, we were farmers, but we had these houses that people lived in. And depending on the state of the farm, when we might have purchased it at the time, some of the houses were in good repair and some of them were actually quite in disrepair or old and neglected and whatnot. And since our business was farming, I'll be frank, we likely didn't put a lot of energy or investment into those houses at the time. And so the rents reflected that. And as a child growing up, I would see the people that were living there in our houses where we were the landlord, and they struggled, but they could make it by, because of the low rent. And, you know, it was always interesting. On the one hand, my dad would complain about them not paying rent, but he never evicted anybody, right? I mean, because they had no place else to go. And so that really imprinted on me the fact that as a youth, there was a significant segment of society that really didn't have resources to find something different. And if individuals didn't do what they could to help them, they were going to be in a lot of trouble. And so I would say that is my very first idea or thinking around the idea of social justice related to housing. And the fact that, no, not everyone has the opportunities or the resources that we might have had. And what does life look like for people like that? And what are the responsibilities of those of us, you know, who can help in some way or straighten the path for them? What can we do there? And so that was probably a very significant imprint on my life as a youth. So that goes way back, and then if you fast forward, I came to the Waterloo Region area for post-secondary education. Had originally intended to go home and farm, and in the early 80s, that didn't pan out. We were in a period of high interest rate and whatnot. So I ended up working locally in the region, in the industrial sector. So, although I was kind of maybe aware of this issue around housing because I was struggling, you know, starting out in the middle of a recession to find housing for myself, at least I had employment. And it wasn't really on my radar. I was really kind of focused on myself, not on the periphery. You know, how it is when you're younger and you get married and you start to have a family and you start to have a career, your focus is really on what's in front of you. And it's very easy to have blinders on and not see what's happening in the world around you. And so, frankly, I wasn't really engaged in the process of housing for much of my working career. I was focused on other things, and that the issues around housing, you might read about it in the newspaper or hear about it on the radio. But it wasn't something that I was actually really, really engaged in, even though I had that early imprint in my life.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, for so long until the past few years, even though there's been a housing crisis accelerating and accelerating for much more time than this, I think it wasn't a central, you know, spotlighted issue in most people's lives. And certainly in journalism and in the media, it was kind of confined to be, you know, there was probably a very restrictive framing over it of thinking, you know, that it was particularly people who either live close to the streets, live rough or access shelter care. And it's only now, I think, that people are really opening up to see that it includes, again, people of many income levels, whole families, children. And it's not this kind of narrow framing that even me growing up in Southern Ontario, I think even for me, it didn't occupy that space where it was so visible, and we were confronting it so much. I think in a lot of ways it was there but hidden. And you're right that when you're, you know, if you're not working directly in this field, life is a lot. And yeah. You're starting out and you're building your career and you're raising a family. That's enough on your plate right there, that when something seems like it has a lot of distance, it is natural for us to kind of to look past it or just to not confront it on a daily basis. So I think your experience is probably shared by many people who would be listening in on this.
Yeah. And so it's been reshaped over the last number of years now. Now I think about housing every day, all day long. Right. And so what changed for me? This past month actually represents 10 years now since I've been at Beyond Housing. So that's certainly been my focus now for the last 10 years. And what brought me to it, you know, I guess for my midlife crisis, instead of going out and buying a little red sports car and driving around in that, I made a career switch and I kind of reshaped the path that I was on. So I left a very good job in the industrial sector for an organization. We built robotics assembly lines and that sort of thing. And I decided I was going to use this kind of the second half of my career and not wait till I was retired to start volunteering or start trying to do some good in the world. I thought I'd do it while I still had some energy and you know, the drive to do that as well. So I left that job and I worked for Midnight Central Committee for about 5.5 years, which was a good introduction to the nonprofit world and the charitable sector here in Warley Region. And then 10 years ago, this opportunity to take on this role at Beyond Housing, then called Menno Homes, presented itself. And it really appealed to me, partially because I had started in the tech sector in kind of a startup entrepreneurial sort of a role. And so the idea of taking a small organization that's kind of nimble like that and, you know, on a bit of a growth trajectory and some plans and where as a generalist, I could be much more involved and engaged in what was going on, as opposed to being very focused and very specialized in a couple of different things. That all appealed to me. And so I made that transition over to what's now called Beyond Housing. And that's kind of my story, is how I've landed here and how, you know, I've suddenly become very interested, obviously, in issues related to housing and housing justice.
Yeah, that's... you're somebody who to briefly use kind of a term that gets bandied around in Christian spaces that I'm in church spaces. You kind of had a dropping your nets moment, which basically is a story about people kind of switching careers when they feel a certain call, a certain vocation. And you particularly made that switch, as you're saying, kind of later in life. You'd really established yourself in a career in the industrial sector. So what was it that, I mean, a lot of people will come across, they'll listen to the show, or they'll read the news and they'll come across and feel passionate about this issue. And it's not everybody's, path in life to get into on a professional or a full-time side. But for you, what was it that made that difference? You said you kind of all of a sudden found yourself then in this, that this opportunity came up, which yes, was Beyond Housing, which was previously called Menno Homes, and worked particularly with the Mennonite Central Committee. But what was it that, you know, when the opportunity came up, actually made you make a life upheaval kind of choice to be able to not just switch your career to a new company and not just switch even into a different field, but to go from, you know, an industrial sector into nonprofit work that is obviously going to be a very different environment. What was it that actually for you was the catalyst that made that shift?
Yeah, it was a big change. There's certainly a haircut on the salary side of things.
So, sure, yeah, I bet. Yeah, so I'm sure there was.
It's not the sort of thing that you do lightly, and it's not the sort of thing that you do independently or alone. I mean, you know, married, family, responsibilities, all those sorts of things, and there's an impact for us on that. I guess to get into the personal side of it, we have a pretty significant history of cancer in my family. And so I've lost a number of siblings to cancer, brain tumors specifically related to a gene deficiency or something like that that we've got. So, and that happened at a very young age. And so I've always understood that, every day that you live is a blessing. Shouldn't be taken for granted. And, you wake up in the morning and go, well, what am I doing with my day today that's going to make a difference in the world? And for the first chunk of my career, it was really around establishing myself and whatnot. And then, when I was in my early 40s, there was a couple of more significant losses. And, as a person of faith, connected with the church, you take all of that and you put it together and at the end of it, there are things that prod and nudge and move you in a certain direction. And for me, that nudging, presented itself with the opportunity that came, to take on a totally different role at Mennonite Central Committee. And then after, 5.5 years at MCC, which I think was, it wasn't part of some master plan. I'm going to go here and then I'm going to do this and then I'm going to do this. But after my time there, I learned a few things about myself. And certainly one of them was that I am much more of a startup entrepreneurial sort of a person than a larger role with the structures and everything else that comes with a large organization like MCC. So that really drew me to the work of, at the time, Menno Homes, now Beyond Housing. And that's the Coles Notes version of that story, I guess. So here I am 10 years later, still trying to figure it out.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, and I think it's beautiful just to hear about, like you said, that for you, it wasn't a plan being executed. It wasn't like scaffolding and a lot of it was where I don't even want to say found yourself, because you still placed yourself in these environments like the Mennonite Central Committee. And obviously, like you said, you were really starting to pay attention to the crisis that was going on. But there was also this sense of, like you say, a nudging, or in Christian spaces, we might say, the Spirit leading us, or others outside of Christian spaces might say there's that calling, there's something in you that's pulling you towards a certain direction. And I always trust inherently when those directions lead to things like what you do, you know, things like creating a more just world around us, creating a world that has more of loving our neighbor in it, then that's a beautiful thing to see. And still, like you said, not an easy one. And to look at the cost of completely kind of changing your work life, you know, the headspace. And like you said, that there is, like, to be honest, there, that there's a cost financially to that too. This is not a career path that people take in order to be able to make profit margins. And so that, I think it's beautiful to hear that, because I think sometimes in our world, it's hard to imagine our world working in different ways, which I think is why the idea of affordable housing can seem so distant to us, because we're just so used to, quote unquote, the way it is, in terms of how housing works, in terms of, you know, some people have, some people don't, you know, that there will always be some people that we see that struggle and that are unhoused. And we get so conditioned into that it's easy to even see the stories in the news, to read them, to be passionate about it, but to still be kind of stuck in the place of just accepting the way it is. And to make a switch and to put yourself in a place where you identified your gifts and thinking, like, there's something in me that has this entrepreneurial spirit, and then to fuse that with the love of your neighbor, I think is a really unique thing. But I think it's something that we all are capable of, and that ability to go, how can I put others in my field of vision, is something that we're all capable of. And again, it might not be a complete career switch for everybody, but the ability to say, how can my life shift in these ways that could actually not only envision our society looking different, but how could I actually be part of putting that into practice, I think is something that is just that we all have the power to do. And so as you got into the role at Beyond Housing, tell me a little bit about what that what you started to see, maybe right off the bat, knowing that the housing crisis changes and evolves, and it has these tentacles that continue to affect people and cities in new ways all the time. But so knowing that even from 10 years ago, I'm sure it's very different now. But when you got into that role, what were the things that you started to see that maybe surprised you, or maybe kind of confirmed things that you'd wondered about in terms of the housing crisis?
Yeah, what did I notice? Because I was on a pretty significant learning curve there, and in many ways I feel like I still am. I mean, it's odd. You end up on a show like this and people ask you questions like you're supposed to be the expert on things, and I'm still learning a ton of information. I continue to be amazed by the people that have such a strong passion for housing justice and the work that they're doing in the community, and really digging into it. And, you know, my mind always goes back to Lynn McCauley, who was one of the first people I ever met in Waterloo Region, and the passion that she brought up around social justice and housing, and just the work that she put into that, to energize a whole room full of people to take action was something that is always really impressive for me. For me personally, you know, I get passionate about doing the best I can in the place I am right now, right? You know, what's the saying? You bloom where you're planted or something like that, right? And so let's get passionate about that. Beyond Housing got started in the early 2000s because at the time, housing was in the news every day. And vacancy rates were low and all that sort of stuff. And at the time in Waterloo Region, there would have been about 3,000 households on the waiting list for affordable housing. And nothing changed, up until the early 2017 or so. It was always about that same number of people. You know, people came on, people came off, and it seemed like everybody seemed to be kind of content with that almost, that we were, oh, okay, well, we're managing it, right? And then all of a sudden in 2017, when the housing sector really started to take off. Prices really started to take off. That was when we started seeing the real increase in the weight of affordable housing wait list, right? And it went from 3,000 to 4,500 to 5,000. You know, now we're up over 7,500. I don't know what the official number is, right?
Yeah, and the last statistic I heard was the potential in just Kitchener-Waterloo for that number to triple in the next 6 or 7 years, even from what it is today. So it just continuing to grow and grow and grow. And so that concept of that we should actually name it the myth that we were managing it, and that even the idea of just, well, let's at least just keep this number of people in our community, this many of our neighbors struggling, that was the low bar that we have set. And I say we're all community members, we're all part of this. We set this low bar, and we imagined into being that we were responding appropriately, that we were responding effectively. And that myth has been obliterated with those numbers that you just shared.
Yeah. No. And so that's the thing, that one of the things that has really, really jumped out at me. But what I was, as I got involved in the sector, what has always stood out for me, and I see this when I've been in other communities as well, I would say, is the collaborative nature of everyone locally in the sector, even though we haven't solved it, even though it's getting worse, to work together, right? And so there's a whole list of organizations, I'm sure many that you've either had on your show or on the lineup for season two.
Yeah.
And this is an incredible community. I mean, and I feel like we're all cheering for each other when somebody has a success. And that's very energizing as well, right? So, yeah. There's, we each have our own roles. We each have our own niches that we work in. And when it comes to things like government grants or donations, we all need them. Now, I live in a world, or have a world view, that says there's plenty. And and so we don't have a world of scarcity. You know, I like to joke sometimes, there's lots of people with deep pockets, just they don't all have long fingers, right?
Yeah, so, I like that. Yeah.
But as far as the community partner agencies that we do our work in and around, there might be a little bit of crossover in some of the folks that we try to support. But in general, it's an incredible community with so many strong partners, and everyone's, I would say, cheering for each other. So that was one thing I learned very quickly as well, that this is just such a strong community that way. That goes to the nonprofits, it goes to the business sector, individuals, churches, what have you. It's good. So we're starting, although it's a desperate crisis, in Waterloo Region, I think we're starting from a position of strength when it comes to that, because at least we're not fighting with each other, right? We're all pulling in the same direction, just trying to figure it out.
Yeah, and you're right. There are so many organizations and individuals and elected officials, civic leaders who are working on this. And I do think in many ways, Kitchener-Waterloo, nobody's got a perfect approach, but there are a lot of things that in our community we've seen people think outside the box, people really innovate and take it very seriously. Again, I mentioned this earlier, this crisis is so comprehensive that it one approach, you know, just emergency shelters or one individual organization is not going to be able to effectively respond to the many niches of need that we find. So tell us a little bit about Beyond Housing's philosophy and approach. And we know we've had organizations and individuals on here who come from the civic sector. We've had faith-based organizations, and so we know that there are so many ways to approach this. So maybe even start with what the philosophy behind Beyond Housing is, and then maybe tell us a little bit about the approach and how Beyond Housing responds to the need in the community for housing.
Yeah. So, I mean, our philosophy, or the thing that we hang our hat on, is that housing is a human right. Everybody has the right to housing, regardless of where they're coming from, their background, their situation, whatever. Everyone has that inherent right as an individual, as a person on this world. And so what is our role in making that possible? And we think, you know, we talk about housing, but, you know, the name change to Beyond Housing, is because we believe that, simply providing housing isn't sufficient, right? Mm. So in addition to housing, people need community, right? They need a structure that meets their physical needs. You know, so if it's around accessibility, no steps, just, you know, simple things like that. So we think those are important. We think that it's important to go beyond, some of the minimums in the building code. You know, yeah. When it comes to things like energy efficiency, you know, if we're going to be on this planet and we want to be good caretakers of it, we have to take some serious thought about what we're doing with our carbon footprint, short term and long term. So, you know, that's part of the beyond for us. Or when you get into something like barrier free units, you know, the building code says you're supposed to have a certain percent. That doesn't say, you know, there's not a maximum for that. There's nothing saying that we can't provide more in order to respond to more people who need that, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, and we try to be innovative in our partnerships as well. And so we don't have a cookie cutter approach to how we do things. If I was to walk you through the various projects that we've done over the last, you know, 20 plus years now, none of them are the same, you know, in terms of partnership with churches, with schools, with other organizations, with the private sector. They're all a little bit different. Certainly makes it interesting. But you know, that's what gets you up in the morning as well, right? Mm-hmm. And so our approach is to say, this is a human issue that we're trying to respond to. Housing happens to be the tool that we're using, right? Which by default then makes us, you know, quote, a developer. But really we're an agency that's responding to human need. And we happen to see housing as the tool that at the very basic level needs to be the first, you know, pillar for them to stand on before they can get the rest of their life in order. So if we take that perspective then, as an organization, we also think it's important to be sustainable. You know, just like we're looking at sustainability of the planet, we think it's important to be financially sustainable as well. And so we have a bit of a different approach than some organizations when it comes to that. From a fundraising perspective, we only raise funds for new project construction. And between government grants and the fundraising that we do, the intention is that even the low rents, when a project is done, are sufficient to carry the ongoing operating costs. And so that we're not going back to the well year after year, asking for more money to keep the project going. Operationally, we are our head office, you know, bookkeeper, my salary, admin people, that sort of thing, that gets covered by 10% of the rent. And so we build that right into our initial budget. And the idea is that project, once it's done, if we've done our budgeting properly, it will sustain itself well into the future. When the roof needs to be repaired 20 or 30 years from now, there will be money to do that. We're not having to get into a crisis down the road. And when those mortgages are eventually retired, there will actually be then money available to invest into new projects. You know, so it starts to have a bit of a snowball sort of an approach to it as we grow as an organization and as we scale up as well. So that long-term sustainability is important so that, you know, we've provided housing, something beyond housing. We've provided homes for people, and we're not going to have to be in a position where we're making financial decisions that put that in jeopardy just to keep the organization alive.
Yeah, and one of the things that I've learned in the past year, and again, I'm a what we'd call in church lingo a lay person. I'm just an everyday person who's on this learning journey. As well, I just get the front row seat, and I get to see who's on Zoom with me instead of just listening. So I get the premium experience that the listeners don't get. But one of the things that I've learned is that one of the problems that is a little more invisible is even for many people that are able in our communities who struggle with housing, even for many of those folks who are able to be housed, keeping them housed, being able to have long-term sustainability is a real issue. And so we know with housing, it's not enough to bring someone in on a cold night. We need to know that next winter that they're going to be covered too, and the winter after that, because as the show is titled, winter is always coming. And so the ability to have sustainability, and again, yeah, to not have these builds, these developments in jeopardy because of the financial strain that many nonprofits often feel, I think is really key for a couple of reasons. One, like I just mentioned, we need to keep people housed. Two, because we know and see this very often where we have sort of temporary affordability in a lot of places where folks are able to get in at a certain rate, but either it's a condo building that eventually will change their policy on affordable units, or somebody gets a unit through a program at an affordable rate, but the next person who comes in, maybe they move on, and the next person who comes in end up just now creating a problem where things do not stay affordable. So I'd love to, this might be a nerdy deep dive, but I think it's important for us to actually dive in here a little more on how that works financially. How is it that can ensure that there is access at an affordable rate, but that has financial sustainability? Can you share a little bit about how you manage to do that? Because to be able to carry the costs of what happens when the new roof needs to be repaired, and how do we make sure that the admin costs, so that this program and the work can keep running, that all that is built in. I think a lot of people would look at that on the surface and go, that's great, but how do you actually then still make sure that it's an affordable rate? And how do you connect that with the right amount of people who can afford that rate? So how, tell us a little bit about how that seems like a hard balance. How do you strike that balance?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. And I'll get into it. I think one thing I should probably clarify as well, just because I didn't get into it, is the type of housing that we provide as well. So we provide housing, it's rental housing, and it's for households right through to seniors. So we don't have one particular demographic, but it is generally for people who can live independently. So we are not a providing 24/7 support services for folks. So it is generally, I would say it's for a hidden population. And so, you know, often you're looking, you know, when you look at the paper, you'll see, you know, references to the tent city or whatever. And that's not the population that we serve, but we're taking care of, you know, in the case of seniors, for example, those that are on fixed incomes that maybe aren't even getting Canada Pension Plan, and their whole income might be $1,800 a month, right?
Yes.
And the average rent, you know, market rent right now is over $2,000.
Over, I think it's $2,200 in KW right now for an average one bedroom condo that may not have any mobility and accessibility options, particularly for seniors, for folks who live with disabilities. We know that that's also beyond what ODSP is. So yeah, this is exactly when we talk about this happens across income levels. We're obviously not talking about the super rich, but we are saying there's folks who are on fixed incomes, things like ODSP. Maybe they're not on Canada Pension Plan, and they need, as you said, everyone needs housing.
Yeah.
So that population is something that I do think gets missed by a lot of us.
They do. They're, because they don't make the front page of the newspaper because they're sitting quietly in their apartment, wherever that may be, trying to figure out how they're going to stretch their food budget and make ends meet.
That is the end of part one of this conversation with Dan Dreger from Beyond Housing. We will be back next week with part two of the conversation as we get more into how Beyond Housing maintains affordable housing output with a sustainable model for their organization, financially sustainable for their organization while keeping housing affordable. We'll find out more about how exactly they do that. Join us next Tuesday for part two of this conversation. For Winter is Coming, I am Adam Cresswell. Thank you for listening. We will see you next Tuesday.